Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. So we finally have the new U.S. strategy for Central Asia. We don't know the full details, but according to the summary, there is a strong emphasis on Washington's continued support for the independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of the region. Although no direct mentioned, but between the lines, there is also plenty of references to Russia and the need for Central Asia to stand up against the growing Chinese influence in the region. As soon as the document hit the internet, it generated diverse reactions, some calling it an old recipe for a new situation, and the others call it a continuity under better conditions. And we are here to expand on this conversation. To do so, I'm joined by Ambassador Dick Hoagland, a retired U.S. diplomat, his most recent assignment being the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary at the State Department's Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs. And the ambassador currently sits on the board of the Caspian Policy Center. Steve Seward Liu is also joining us, who's the human rights lawyer and expert on Central Asia, and his most recent assignment being Human Rights Watch's regional researcher in Central Asia. Nargis Kasanova, Associate Professor of International Studies at the Kazakhstan's Kimep University and currently a Senior Fellow at the Harvard University's Davis Center for Russia and Eurasia Studies. Bruce Panier is also joining us, who's the Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So let me start with you, Ambassador Hoagland. I was told by the authors of the document that there has been a considerable exchange of opinions between you and the authors of the strategy during the preparation. And of course, we know your critical role in the previous U.S. strategies on Central Asia. So the authors of the report say it was such a timely document given the recent changes in Central Asia. But there's a community of experts who say there is nothing new in this document. So when you put this and the previous documents together, what do you see? What are some of the differences and similarities?
Well, thank you for inviting me today. I'm very pleased to participate in this. As you might know, I helped to write the previous strategy for Central Asia for the National Security Council. And in the earlier stages of this one, yes, that's correct, I was consulted and I had some input. What I see that is important for this one, and it's really a win for Central Asia, given the tendency of the U.S. government now to reorder its priorities and to cut back in certain parts of the world, there is no cutback here. Yes, there's continuity, there's recognition of new situations, but the really big win is that support in many different ways is going to continue for Central Asia without any kind of a drawback, and I think that's important.
And about the six-point agenda on the document, what's new in that?
I would say there's nothing especially new in that, but as you pointed out in your introduction, especially in the official version, there is a recognition of challenges for Central Asia coming from Russia, especially the information sphere, and of course from China with its Belt and Road Initiative and its growing political and economic clout in the region. So I would say that those are certainly new. And then, of course, it recognizes the terribly important changes in Uzbekistan, which is helping to draw together the entire region as a much stronger bloc than it has ever been before.
Right. So here I have to admit that we have not seen the full document, and also the author could not join the discussion. I tried both the National Security Council and the State Department. So we might be trying to make sense of this thing in darkness. However, what we can see is the six-point article on the summary. So let me get, Steve, your point in that, how you compare this with the previous strategy documents.
Well, yeah, and first let me say it's an honor to be on the panel with Ambassador Hoagland and Nargis, both of whom I so respect in this field and their contributions. And I think the perspective I have as a human rights lawyer is more that, you know, this document is an expression of public advocacy. It's public diplomacy. And it, in some ways, it means all things to all people. And in some ways, it's a very open book. I think a lot of folks like me are projecting various ideas onto it. But I think what I'm struck by from a human rights perspective is the general, you know, in terms of the point of nothing new, in terms of promoting human rights, in terms of fighting corruption, in terms of sort of recognizing some of the major risks and threats that have stuck around in the region for so long and are persistent problems, I think there should be more of a recognition of that. I mean, one obviously recognizes the change in paradigm given Uzbekistan opening up to the region and the amazing positive aspect that that's introduced in terms of interregional cooperation. That, of course, I don't criticize the document for focusing a lot on that new paradigm, which is so important for U.S. policy and for the region. But I'm a little bit struck by the, you know, 25 years in, there seems to be, again, stock language that seems to just repeat that, you know, U.S. policy is to support sovereignty, stability, security. All, of course, are important. But, you know, we know that Turkmenistan is sovereign. We know that Tajikistan is sovereign. But what is that getting us? And in terms of the U.S. and its unique contribution and dedication to promoting what it can in the region, democracy, rule of law, human rights, which is the main thing that makes it different than China and Russia, I think those aspects should be taking more of a prominent role in the way this is described. And there should be some recognition of the current threats to those things, such as corruption, which is tearing apart so many of these different countries, and obviously authoritarianism, and sort of, I think dealing with that more head on is something that probably a lot of the experts expected, because we just saw Secretary of State Pompeo being quite brash and quite open in the way he was in the region just recently. So there's some dissonance, I think. There's some disconnect, a sense of the document trying to be too many things and maybe not enough things.
Mm. I think Ambassador will have something to add into this. But before that, let's also get Nargis and Bruce, your points on this document, and then we will get back to the Ambassador to respond to some of these points.
Shall I start?
Sure.
It is my first Majlis podcast, and it's great. It's great to join you finally.
Thank you.
I'm with those who couldn't spot much new in this document. I agree that, well, support of sovereignty and independence, of course, it started with the beginning of independence, something very precious, very important, and I'm happy that it continues to be the core of the U.S. approach toward the region. But it's not new, right? Yeah. Connectivity, that's also, we hear it from 2011, and we don't use the word connectivity then, even earlier when the U.S. started supporting the developing transport corridors between Europe and Central Asia via the Caucasus. Terrorism, fighting terrorism, strengthening borders, that's also something we heard before. We can date it to at least to 2001. Human rights, rule of law, that predates independence, I would say. So we didn't really hear anything about new approaches, and overall the document is very laconic. I thought it doesn't flesh out the concrete steps and approaches, and it was very interesting to hear Ambassador Alice Wells when the strategy was launched the other day, and she was much more concrete. And what she was saying about the infrastructure projects, basically the standards that these infrastructure projects should compile with, you can find these points in the other strategy that came out last year, the joint regional strategy for South and Central Asia, which is much more concrete, and it mentions Russia, it mentions China, so it sort of fleshes out, I thought, much better the U.S. approach.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, your points briefly?
I got to admit, I was one of the people who looked at this and thought that I've pretty much seen all this stuff before. You know, I know since 9/11, security has been a major component of U.S. relations towards Central Asia. I'm in the camp that thought that the U.S. policy in the 1990s was probably more productive for the region and the people of the region, because it did have a much heavier emphasis on human rights. And you could see that even if the governments didn't like it, they understood the position the U.S. was coming from. And how many times have you heard that argument that the governments of the region have to balance their relations? So there's no way they're going to cast out a major power like the United States from their from the foreign relations equation. There's no doubt about that. So I think that we can press this, and it's very important at a time when there is transition in the two biggest countries in Central Asia, is to be pushing them on some of these things. Because really, you know, I traveled around a lot in the 90s, and that was one of the things that the people would tell me distinguished the United States from other players, is that they seemed to have the feeling that the United States was kind of on the side of the people of the country. And, you know, I've used this example before, but we remember the tragedy in Andijan in May of 2005. And 1 week before that, there were farmers demonstrating outside the U.S. Embassy for greater rights. They came from southern Uzbekistan, because they thought that the U.S. had raised these issues before. So if you had a problem in Central Asia, and not just in Uzbekistan and other countries, but in other countries of Central Asia, a lot of times people would go outside the U.S. Embassy and demonstrate, hoping that the United States government would pay attention to this and press their own governments to change the rights. And I thought that gave us much higher ground, you know, certainly more esteem among the people of the region. So I would have personally liked to have seen that raised a lot. You know, the points on connectivity, you know, the U.S. has contributed to that, but at the end of the day, we got to face it that, you know, Belt and Road is really the connectivity thing, and the U.S. is not a player in that at all. I thought the U.S. policy should be much more supportive of the Asian Development Bank's Carrick program, which actually China has ripped off and made into Belt and Road, if you look at the maps. But this would have been another place where the U.S. could have set our strategies to support Asian Development Bank, which we always did on this project, the Carrick project. Right. And that also would have been another place where we could have got high ground and a lot of points for things that we have contributed in Central Asia. Right. I know this isn't the whole policy that I looked at, it's just a summary, but those are just a couple things that hit me immediately, is that I'd wished that there had been more talk on, certainly on the rights angle, support for democratic institutions, and mention of connectivity, but within the Asian Development Bank, and I know they did mention CASA 1000 during that.
So, Ambassador Hoglund, there are a lot to unpack here. So, of course, I would like you to respond to that, but there are also speakers on the Majlis always been very polite to each other in the discussion and their reactions. I realize the difference of opinions only in the heated discussion that we usually have when the podcast is over. So, I really encourage you guys to jump in when you like to add anything or want to react into someone's opinion. So please keep that in mind. So Ambassador Hoglund, please, you know, there were many highlights in the Steve, Nargis and Bruce's reaction to this report. The one being that there was really nothing new. So, of course, you have a different look into this. Any response to the points raised in our colleagues' remarks?
The challenge that there is nothing new in this. You know what? I would look at that from the other side and say, thank God that it continues, because U.S. policy in Central Asia has been very broad-based from the very beginning. To add anything dramatically new, there would hardly really be room for it. It's a matter of emphasis. The one thing that I do want to respond to is the comment about human rights. Anyone that knows me, human rights is one of my core values, both personally and professionally. But what I discovered working for many years in Central Asia, when I was ambassador in Tajikistan, when I was acting ambassador in Turkmenistan, when I was ambassador in Kazakhstan, in the past, over the past 20 years, the United States has certainly delivered many, many messages and had conversations with senior leaders in the region about human rights specifically. The problem that I saw during my career was that we often came at this with a kind of finger wagging, talking down and saying, here is what you must do. In my experience, I found much, much more response from the officials in the region when we did this a little bit more quietly and empathically, when we built the relationships with the leaders so we could explain what we were really talking about. And I am absolutely certain that this kind of talk with senior leaders will continue. Does it mean that there will be dramatic changes coming soon? I doubt it. But the United States does indeed stand up for human rights and rule of law and the other issues related to that, corruption, because corruption and rule of law issues make it difficult for groups like the International Financial Organizations, the Asian Development Bank, all the others, International Financial Corporation, to really move forward and to draw investment into the countries. So all of those are listed here in this new or this newly released strategy for Central Asia. And quite frankly, I'm very glad to see that. This is part of day-to-day diplomacy. Huh.
Could I jump in for a moment on
sure.
the human rights point as well?
I
really appreciate what Ambassador Hoagland has just said, and I think all of us here completely agree that private diplomacy and the building of rapport, and obviously the opposite of finger wagging, you know, it has been the hallmark of the mostly amazing U.S. diplomats that have represented the region for so long and worked so hard on human rights. I think what strikes me here and at this moment where the U.S. position globally on human rights is under such grave threat, we have to be clear about that. I think perhaps that aspect of what's happening in the world of, you know, recent events very adjacent to the region, for example, the assassination of Soleimani, the Uyghur question, which so dominated Pompeo's visit to the region and was also, you know, on display at the discussion of the Heritage Foundation, and the emphasis on that human rights issue and not the suppression of peaceful assembly in Kazakhstan over the past year, or the corruption protests in Kyrgyzstan going on now, or the religious freedom crackdown in Tajikistan. There's just, again, there's this sense, I think, of what, and I completely agree with Ambassador Hoagland, that a broad-based strategy, in a way, it's right. We should be thankful that there's no retreat on those core U.S. principles. But I think given everything that's happening in the region and the U.S. is more, let's say, robust or brash, again, positions on foreign policy and human rights, its own particular interpretation of what human rights are, and I'm speaking now of the Secretary of State, I think there's an appetite and there's a requirement that any public statements about human rights in Central Asia be a bit more concrete and a bit, you know, commit more to what it is that the U.S. wants to see and do. Otherwise, I think there's a very legitimate opening up to criticism that the U.S. is pursuing very biased interests, or let's say, you know, talking about Uyghurs only in Kazakhstan, not talking about freedom of assembly. That struck me.
Can I jump in as
sure.
well? Well, it seems to me there is a bigger problem. It's bigger than human rights in Central Asia, obviously, that human rights are less center stage for U.S. foreign policy under the current administration, or they become center stage when, you know, depending on the on who is violating human rights. So if it's China, then, you know, you do hear this kind of clear articulation. If it's Saudi Arabia, less so. And I was also quite surprised how polite this new strategy is. And I was struck actually by one sentence. I can quote it. U.S. embassy programs provide hundreds of journalists with skills and networks necessary to help keep governments accountable to their citizens. And okay, which is fine, and highlight new government efforts to improve the lives of everyday people. So in a way, you don't need encouragement for that, I would think. So, yes, I agree with these points.
Yeah, Ambassador, of course, I would like to invite you to respond to this. And also, we realize that you are not the author of this report and you are not participating as a representative of the government, the administration here. But you were the closest person we could get to this document. So thank you for joining us on this podcast. So could you please talk a little bit about the human rights aspects of that and also the points that Nergis has read? I mean, could there be a more stronger emphasis, more clarity on what U.S. really means on the articles about the human rights and rule of law?
Yes, of course, I'd be glad to do that. And thank you for pointing out that I no longer represent the United States government, although I am still deeply interested in what we're doing.
Right.
I still have many colleagues who are actively involved in all of this. I think from the very beginning of the independence of these countries, there has been a real debate in Washington and other parts of the world, certainly in Europe, about the human rights policy. No one will ever say that each of those countries has reached a really high standard of supporting human rights. But what I want to point out is that there are human rights problems in our part of the world, too, in the United States. And that's the kind of thing that we have to keep in mind. I think that there are plenty of references, maybe not enough to satisfy everyone, but plenty of references to human rights and rule of law in the public version of the strategy for Central Asia that you have access to. There is also the official version, unclassified, which I have read. It's a little bit more direct on some of the issues that have been raised that you said were between the lines. And then, of course, there is a classified version, which gets really down in the weeds of how the United States government is going to implement some of these policies, especially on the security side and on counterterrorism side. All in all, I have to say that the current strategy, I think, maintains a very good balance. It doesn't satisfy everyone because it doesn't put their concerns up front. Nevertheless, all of the concerns are mentioned in here, and I know absolutely from experience and from talking with current colleagues that all of these concerns are very much on the table. They are very much discussed with the government. The most important thing is to find the right way to move these into a proper direction. I think that's what's important about this.
So within this document, there are a couple of other points which I thought is important to expand on, the most important of which was emphasize on Central Asia standing up on its own feet. Of course, this was mentioned in the context of sovereignty and territorial integrity, but it was more clear during the conversation with the U.S. Representatives at the Heritage Foundation when the report was launched. So this brings us to China's growing role, and there have been already sort of reaction to this by the Uzbek foreign minister last week on this topic. So let's continue the Majlis podcast talking about this and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Ambassador Dick Hoagland, former U.S. official responsible for its strategy on Central Asia, Steve Severlow, human rights lawyer and Central Asia expert, Nergis Kasanova, associate professor of international studies at the Kazakhstan Eskimov University and currently a senior fellow at the Harvard University's Davis Center, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing U.S.'s new strategy on Central Asia. So, Bruce, you follow the region probably more than any of us do. So, when this thing was launched the other day at the Heritage Foundation, what was the news from the region? How did they react to it? What were some of their initial takeaways from this this report or document?
The only media reports I've seen on this so far came out of Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, and they both parroted more or less what was in the summary that was released and some of the comments that were made during the conference, the release of the strategy the other day. A couple of things have happened that kind of not clouded the water so much, but got mixed in with this. You know, the visit of Secretary of State Pompeo was one, the decision to put Kyrgyzstan on the list of countries that had the temporary restrictions on immigration visas was another. So the reaction wasn't totally focused on this. There were other issues that people were looking at the same time, especially Secretary of State Pompeo's comments about China, because in Kazakhstan, of course, that generated a lot of talk about what exactly was the government's policy on this. And as usual, the government was trying to keep out of getting involved with this and saying anything that might be taken as critical of China. So the reaction was pretty much straight up quoting this. I don't think much of this would have been a surprise to the people so much. And I suppose in some ways that's kind of a concern, because I do understand the policy that the U.S. has been trying to implement in Central Asia and trying to help the governments get forward. But I know from someone that's been on the ground, and Steve's traveled around there too, that if you ask people what the U.S. policy is towards Central Asia, you're probably likely to get a much different response than anything that was written in this summary. For instance, you know, sadly, the U.S. image in a lot of these places is not much different than it would have been when these places were republics in the Soviet Union. Very distrustful of American motives, not sure that America is on their side for, you know, everyday things and stuff, but more the interest in Central Asia is focused on security. And even that, with the U.S. signaling that it wants to certainly reduce its role in Afghanistan, a lot of people have the idea that we're going to pretty much abandon a lot of things in Central Asia. I don't believe that's true. I'm just saying that's what I hear when I'm out there in the region. And if you look at the document, and I wanted to ask Ambassador Hoagland about this too, if specifically the language in these documents is intended to be the way it is. Now, this summary only mentions the names of the Central Asian countries in the foreword, and never gets back to them and speaks about it as a region. And I understand that for reasons of connectivity and things. But Nargiz and I were on the advisory council for the European Union's strategy for Central Asia. And that, even when it wasn't specifically mentioned in a country, you could see where parts of this were directed toward one or two countries. It was very obvious to anyone who was involved with the region that they were speaking specifically about Kyrgyzstan or Kazakhstan or something without even mentioning them. This is a little more general. And so I'm curious if that's meant to be that way and that the other documents are more specific, or what is the reason for not addressing, saying, mentioning the country's names throughout this and saying, with Uzbekistan, we want to do this. With Kazakhstan, we're looking for this.
Ambassador?
Okay. I'm very glad, Bruce, that you brought up one very important thing here. You know, when you read government documents, you almost have to put on special glasses and maybe read the tea leaves very closely. What struck me, not only about this document that's available to us, but also from what I've heard people like Ambassador Wells say in public about policy in various venues over the last year or so, is a real recognition, and this is a shift, of the new attempts by Central Asia countries to work together. What started this was the coming to power of President Mirziyoyev in Uzbekistan. In the first year of his administration, his reaching out to the other countries in the region, as well as to the surrounding countries, was really a major development. And I know for a fact that there were various groups following from that that began to look officially at, for example, how is ASEAN constructed and what does it do? How is the Baltic Council constructed and what does it do? I think that whole process got slowed down a little bit by the change of government in Kazakhstan when President Nazarbayev stepped aside to a degree and President Tokayev came in. But nevertheless, that process continues. In the longer term, I think what's going to happen in Central Asia is that not a unity of the four, five countries into one country, but some sort of political and economic bloc. And that's going to be very, very important because that will strengthen the political power and independence of the political power of the region. And ultimately, it will help the people with prosperity in the region. Will that come soon? No, but it's in process. And I think when you listen very closely and read very closely what U.S. officials are saying, that they recognize that. And that is something new. That wasn't available before.
I wondered if, Nargis, you have any point to raise here. Otherwise, also... What's that?
If I can add a couple of...
Yeah.
I don't think this strategy will get much traction in the region because there isn't much to capture the attention. It's very laconic, it's very polite, and well, the only thing that might sort of be discussed is, you know, that 3 out of 6 policies are Afghanistan connected.
Yeah.
So we have it in the foreword or somewhere in the introduction that the region is important in, on its own terms, but then, you know, when you look at the like concrete policies, then you see Afghanistan in them. And that's something that would reinforce this perception that, you know, that we are viewed from through the Afghanistan lens still. Also what Bruce said about the EU strategy that came out last year, it's also a very polite document. European documents are generally very polite, but it's much more concrete. And you can see concrete steps and you can see, you know, concrete countries. So in a way, it's an open document, it's a public document, but it's, it is quite quite concrete. Probably we have something like that is classified.
It's also a little bit expanded, I guess, what we have now.
Yeah, Nargis, I wonder if I might add to that. I thank you very much for those comments about Afghanistan. Inevitably, in real politique, meaning you accept what is actually going on in the region, of course the United States policy has to focus on Afghanistan. We've been there for a very long time. It's still a very unsettled country. And the countries of Central Asia worry about Afghanistan and what will happen there, but not only worry, they are increasingly trying to help in Afghanistan. And what that means is, over the longer period of time, Afghanistan will be knit into the understanding of what is Central Asia. In my experience, and I spent many years working on Afghanistan too, Afghanistan is certainly a Central Asian country. And in the much, much longer term, I think that's where things are going. And our policy has to recognize that. It doesn't mean that we are belittling anything in Central Asia because we want to focus only on Afghanistan, but it's a far-ranging view that will say someday Afghanistan will be part of Central Asia, and that will help enormously with the connectivity. You know, CASA 1000 got held up for a number of years because of the unsettled situation. Some of the pipeline projects coming from Central Asia that would hope to cross through Afghanistan are held up because of the unsettled situation. So if the world working together can help settle things in Afghanistan, that will be to the advantage of Central Asia. And I think we will see that in future policies, too.
You know, can I say just one sentence?
Sure.
Just to clarify, I'm not trying to belittle Afghanistan, and I think developing cooperation between Central Asian states and Afghanistan is a very important thing and good thing. But Afghanistan is important, you know, challenges and opportunities that are related to it are important, but it's not the biggest thing. That's something that, you know, is important, is underway. And when, for example, connectivity, you already mentioned connectivity and Belt and Road Initiative, and you really need to kind of try to read between the lines to kind of try and understand the approach. And it would be, I guess, beneficial for everybody if it was more fleshed out.
You know, this also builds on the already existing opinion of people that the U.S. has been looking into Central Asia for a long time through the lens of Afghanistan. So it kind of these things comes together, and then you have a conclusion like this. And also, other than Afghanistan, there's another regional issue that I have seen in this document emphasized probably more than in previous reports. That is about the China. And of course, in the report, it doesn't say much, but it was more clear during the presentation of this document at the Heritage Foundation. I think Lisa Kurtz was very much open, saying that, what was the exact word? So in fact, saying that Central Asia needs to stand up or face the risk of Chinese domination. I asked this question the other day to Alice Wells during the conversation, who's the Deputy Principal Assistant Secretary for Southern Central Asia at the State Department. My question was kind of, what is the concern and what United States wants from Central Asian authorities to do about this? Is there any insight, Ambassador Hoglund, on that? What's the concern about and what United States wants Central Asian countries to do about it?
Yes, thank you for asking. I think I'm very glad that we still have time to mention China in relation to Central Asia. China's Belt and Road Initiative, which was originally announced, ironically, at Nazarbayev University in the capital of Kazakhstan, then Astana, it has grown over the years, it has changed over the years, and one of the key elements of Belt and Road Initiative, which is almost global, runs right through Central Asia. The problem that has developed over the years that we clearly see is that sometimes China's lending for these projects, and they aren't all freebies, the lending is often predatory, and it leads to real serious problems within the countries. I think what we're doing to a degree in this new strategy is calling attention to the countries to be a little bit cautious about how they approach this. You know, quite recently, the United States, along with Australia and Japan, I believe, announced the Blue Dot Initiative. This is not new lending, but it's trying to say that any kind of development project in Central Asia should meet international standards, basically Western standards of investment. And sometimes China doesn't do that. We also have to keep in mind that as China's influence in the region grows increasingly dramatic, so far is basically soft power. But inevitably, in foreign relations, foreign policy, hard power follows soft power. We've already seen one initial report of a Chinese military or border security outpost in Tajikistan, but in my humble opinion, I think there's more of that to come. And so the Central Asian countries and their friends in Europe and North America need to really think very carefully. How much hard power do they want to see from China on their territories?
Nargis, your focus is also China. So does the Central Asian authorities see the Chinese influence the way the United States sees it?
Well, I guess not, because for us, China is a very important partner, partner in security, partner in development, and so on and so forth. But of course, the power imbalance between China and Central Asian states is very, very considerable. So there is awareness of that. And if you look at public sentiments also, yeah, there is the anti-Chinese sentiments are considerable. We cannot ignore them either. But actually, if I can go back to what Ambassador Hoagland said, I think these are very important things, and these are new developments and very interesting initiatives that the U.S. is undertaking, developing its response to China's Belt and Road Initiative and what it stands for. And during that Heritage Foundation launch, I'm very happy, Mohammed, you asked that question and we would hear more about it. We heard about the Development Finance Corporation. We heard about the Build Act that initiated this reformatting of OPIC. We heard about the Blue Dot Initiative that the U.S. is doing together with Japan and Australia. These are very important things, and they are relevant for Central Asia. So in this regard, I wish we would see presence of these initiatives in the strategy, not at the expense of Afghanistan connection and all that, but definitely that's what I refer to, saying that there is a bigger game in town, you know, that would make the strategy more strategic. It's interesting to me that you referred to it as a report. In a way, to some extent, it does read like a report, you know, giving all these numbers of persistent students and so on, rather than a really strategy.
Yeah, so we are also running out of time. So let's conclude the discussion here. Just to add a final thoughts on China, I think the reaction by the Uzbek foreign minister the other day in response to Secretary Pompeo's suggestion that Central Asia to be doing more on standing up against China was, I think, kind of very telling, in which he basically said that they don't like to be in the middle of a battle between superpowers. I thought that was very interesting and also telling on where Central Asia stands when it comes to China. So let's end the discussion with a couple of final thoughts. So Steve, now that we have the U.S. strategy for Central Asia, which we all thought as an important document given sort of a retreat by the United States on a number of other fronts, so what could be done so that this strategy achieves what it intends to achieve? You have seen the previous strategies, you have seen the outcome. So what are the lessons from the previous documents? So especially on what comes next once the strategy is announced?
Yeah, no, and this has been such a wide-ranging discussion. I mean, to start with maybe the points on China and move outward, in terms of developing the resilience within the region to, you know, again, the not mentioned explicitly in the text but ever-present Russia and China, you know, and the threats they pose to democracy, rule of law, sovereignty, all those things are looming in the text. But I'm one of those people that, going back to what Bruce said in the beginning of the podcast, that if the U.S. really wants to develop the resilience within the region to withstand those challenges, I mean, we see the proliferation of facial recognition technology in buses in Astana, and we see in Tashkent, we see that encroachment, we see that risk to human rights. But I'm one of those people that thinks that in order to strengthen that resilience, there needs to be a stronger commitment, both in word, but more importantly, in action by the U.S. government and its policy to, again, defending core U.S. values, recognizing, I think, in public diplomacy, but also, as Ambassador Hoagland said, in private discussions, recognizing that the authoritarianism, and we have two countries now that are CPCs, countries of particular concern for violations of religious freedom, Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, recognizing that that is not changing, that in fact it's deteriorating. We see Tajikistan slipping between 2015 and 2020 into a much worse human rights situation. I think acknowledging those not just persistent and ongoing problems, but increasing problems, is going to be the core to the U.S. making its mark, of the U.S. being able to continue its legacy in terms of its policy, as we've talked about the continuity here, but making it stronger, making it more effective, I think requires a more explicit commitment to those ideals. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, some of the other aspects that we hear nothing about here, for example, LGBT rights, something that U.S. policy and Secretary of State Clinton emphasized when she was at the helm, completely absent here. And the Kyrgyzstan travel ban, I think that happening at the same time, and this sort of challenged the idea of freedom of movement and fundamental U.S. values in terms of openness. I think that, again, it sends this message, which is, at the very least, it muddies the waters, and it creates these huge perception problems in the region about what the U.S. stands for, what it really wants. So, in terms of Russia and China and those incredibly important equation, U.S. needs to walk taller and, I think, live its ideals. And I think all of us, in a way, generally are agreeing with the sense of the frustrations and the limitations of a document of this character.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that's important going forward.
Yeah, and also, to be fair with the authors of the strategy, that we just see the final product and comment, in our case, mostly critique it, which is an easy part of this whole equation. But God knows what goes into each word they choose to place on the paper and the calculation behind it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we will keep an eye on what happens next. Now, the same question to you, Nargis. Given that the U.S. has had a strategy on Central Asia in the past, we were more or less aware what came out of that over the years, and we discussed it in details on today's show. So keeping that in mind, what has to happen following the announcement of this strategy so that it doesn't go in vain, so that the desired outcomes are achieved? Is there anything that the U.S. government should be doing differently at this time around to make this more effective in the implementation process?
Well, I'm not responsible for the implementation of this
six
policies, yes. But I would pay more attention to the governance issues, good governance issues, and rule of law, human rights, the kind of bigger connectivity issues. And I would be very happy if the travel ban will be lifted. Travel ban on Kyrgyz citizens would be lifted. I think that would really send a good signal.
Okay, Bruce, so what are the points you will be looking to see that there is a follow-up to achieve what the document desires to achieve? And also, what are the points you will be looking at to determine that there is a follow-up on this?
Well, you know, as far as security is concerned, that's just a given. You know, that's going to happen one way or another. What I would be looking for is to see, very valuable, as mentioned in the document, mentioned all along, is the respect for sovereignty of the country and what the U.S. can do to help them build that. Because I think at the end of the day, that's probably what's going to get us the most mileage of that. If we can look like a benign, interested but not totally interested for personal reasons partner in what's going on in Central Asia, and we just want them to be able to stand on their own two feet and move forward and not be put in a position where they could be subjected to pressure by China or Russia, you know, that might be the best outcome of, like, a guy who's on your side against these other giant neighbors that you have that wants to see you do well. And like I said, unfortunately, when I go through the region, I get this inevitably in several places where people think that we're only there because there's something in it for us. And as soon as we get what we want or decide it's not worth it, we'll leave, you know. So the message has got to be, we're here with you as a partner. We want to help you. We want to see you go forward. We don't want you to be in debt for the rest of your life. We don't want your governments to put themselves in a position where they are so beholden to countries like China and Russia, where they have to listen and base their policies on what Beijing and Moscow tell them to do. So I think that would probably be the best gift the U.S. could give to the region, if the people would believe that we're just there to help them out, and that we really don't have any other interests but that, then that would probably go a long ways in implementing everything else that's in this strategy.
Ambassador, obviously, because of your previous experiences and assignments, you have a different look into this. Now that we have this document, what are the areas we should be looking at as a journalist in terms of how U.S. follows up with the recommendations that they have in this document for Central Asian countries?
Well, that's a very good question. And first of all, I want to thank the other participants in this program for their very fine comments. There's nothing that I disagree with that I've heard. The thing about diplomacy is, on a day-to-day basis, we have values, we have core values, we have standards, we have written policies, but in the real world, it's always a gray area. It's not black and white. And so on a certain day after a certain event, you will emphasize one particular thing. The next week, you may have to emphasize a slightly different thing. What pleases me about U.S. policy, not just as written in this new strategy, but for the last nearly 30 years of independence in these countries, is that we have been consistent and steadfast from the very beginning. We were among the very first countries to recognize the independence of the Central Asian countries. And I think we have been there right all along, and we will continue to be there. We're not going to cut and run as soon as we get something that we want. That's not the way the United States works anywhere in the world, and it's not the way it works in Central Asia either.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us today, Ambassador Dick Hoglund, former U.S. Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary at the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs. Also, big thanks goes to Steve Severlu, human rights lawyer and Central Asia expert, Nargis Kasanova, Associate Professor of International Studies at the Kazakhstan Eskimov University and currently a Senior Fellow at the Harvard University's Davis Center, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Thank you, colleagues, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis podcast. Until next week. Bye-bye.